Good morning and welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists in Philadelphia. Here at the United Lodge of Theosophists, our policy, broadly speaking, is summed up in a very short but powerful declaration, which says that the policy of the Lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy. Independent devotion to the cause of theosophy, without profession to any theosophical organizations. The work that we have as a family of associates, of volunteer associates, simply is the promulgation of the principles of the United Lodge, the principles of the philosophy, as recorded in the writings of H.P. Blavatsky and William Q. Judge. This is the work of the Lodge. Anything other than that is considered an outside issue. So personal opinions of how things should be run, or dissensions, differences of opinion, are just, there's no time for it because of the type of work, the nature of the work, and the direction of the effort. So therefore, there are no really real personality issues because there are no officers, there are no bylaws, there's no constitution to follow. Rather, there is a direction that a family of volunteers pursues, a direction that was pointed out by the founders of the movement. And the basis that we have for union as a family is the similarity of the aim and the purpose and the teachings of the philosophy of theosophy. The work of the Lodge is, as we said, the dissemination of the fundamental principles and the exemplification in practice of those principles, which ultimately will lead one to a truer realization of the self, a truer realization of who we are at the core, and a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. That said, the Lodge recognizes anyone and everyone to be a theosophist who is engaged in the true service of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. Now, to fulfill this declaration and continue to promulgate the ideas, we here in Philadelphia offer meetings twice a week. On Wednesdays, the Lodge opens at 5:30, and there's a reference library available and open to the public. All the meetings are free and open to the public, and this reference library is open from 5:30 to 7:30 on Wednesdays. On Wednesday evening from 7:45 to 9 o'clock, we have a class on the principles of theosophy. We follow the writings in a particular book called The Ocean of Theosophy, written by William Q. Judge. And that's promptly ends at 9 o'clock. On Sundays, the doors open at 10:30, and each Sunday we have a forum or a lecture or a panel discussion on various theosophical topics, and that is from 11 to 12. Now, in the foyer, you'll notice a book table which makes available straight line theosophical pamphlets, magazines, and books for purchase by the public. The price is set at the cost to the Lodge. There's no profit involved with the sale of anything here at the Lodge. That said, all meetings are open to the public and are free, and any contributions that one might desire to make in terms of time, service, or money are certainly welcome. However, there is no obligation imposed or implied. Now, this morning, we have a presentation on the rebirth, for the month, the umbrella theme, the umbrella topic for the month, is next month's cycles. And this is next month. That's okay. We'll talk about that. is cycles, and today we're going to have a talk on Christmas and rebirth during the Christmas season.
The season of rebirth. Christmas is a Christian festival, presently celebrated on December 25th and commemorating the birth of Jesus, called Christ. It is the most popular festival in the Christian calendar and has become increasingly elaborated over the years with a lot of customs, such as decorating a fir tree, which was drawn from the pagans. In addition, it has absorbed some later Christian practices, such as erecting an elaborate nativity scene. More recent secular practices include exchanging presents, often claimed to come from Santa Claus, a figure most popularized in New York in the 19th century, the name being a modification of a Dutch Sinterklaas, a popular alteration of St. Nicholas, a 4th century bishop who, according to legend, saved three girls from prostitution by throwing bags of gold into their window at night. Another secular addition is exchanging greeting cards, a practice begun around 1846. Whatever the reason for choosing December 25th, that date is esoterically appropriate. For one thing, associating the birth of a world teacher with the rebirth of the sun, which is symbolic of our spiritual self. Ages before the time of Jesus Christ, among all the ancient peoples, were ceremonies at this season of the year, similar in kind to our own, which had reference to a certain occurrence in the events of time. For it is then that the sun itself returns from its journey southward to the north again. And the coming of the sun was understood to be the birth of the sun. The exact date of Jesus' birth is a matter of debate, but it is generally acknowledged that it was not December 25th. That date was adopted most likely in the 4th century of the Common Era. That date was chosen by early Christians because it coincided with the culmination of the Roman festival of Bromalia, celebrating the birth of Bacchus. And Bruma is the ancient Latin name for the shortest day of the year, the winter solstice, which the Julian calendar fixed on December 25th. Christmas is a season of birth and of growth. It is the season of the rebirth of the spiritual nature, and the birth of Jesus was made to accord with his old knowledge of the past and ancient observances. This season has its own peculiar occult reference. It is the season of the coming back and bringing into fruitation those seeds and plants needing sun energy for their growth and expression. But it is more than that, because behind the sun and behind every single body, there is spirit, there is life, and there is intelligence. So there comes with the return of the sun a spiritual, a mental, a moral uplifting. There is a springtime, not only in the lower kingdoms, among plants and animals, but among men. There is an incursion of energy, so to speak, which if we could take advantage of, would enable us to do much more than we do now. But we have lost the knowledge that we once had. We have forgotten, and so we do not apply ourselves to the fact of the recurrence of the real Christmas time. This season, not only the physical renewal of the earth and all beings, but also a return of the inner life and of impulse of a spiritual kind. As applied to the individual, the festival of the winter solstice symbolizes soul awakening, which lies latent in the recesses of everyone's heart. This awakening of the divinity in the heart of the individual is referred to as his second birth. Christmas is a season of the rebirth of the spiritual nature of divine wisdom, or Christos. Christmas is the year's moment of truth. It is the consummation of the ancient resolve, I will arise and go to my Father. What is this Father but the indwelling spirit that sustains all life? Out in space, our planet approaches its perihelion at Christmas, the point in its orbit nearest to the sun. This could symbolize for us what may be happening among all humanities. We are drawing nearer to the great essentials. Something in us has responded to the great harmony. Theosophists look upon Christmas in two ways. First, as the record of a sublime fact in occult history and life, that every son of man, someday in his own spiritual history, will repeat it if he climbs successfully. And the other way, that there is an unborn Christ in the soul of every one of us. The Christos, the Prince of Peace, the Prince of Love. As the cycling days bring this Christmas season around, and the Christian world celebrates the supposed birth of the physical body of its chief, its Savior, the Christ, in their highest sense, that we humans are the sons of God, of the divine, and that the spirit of love and consciousness of the Most High dwelleth in the sanctuary of every man's heart, which means that there is a Christ child in my heart and in yours. Some Orientals call it the celestial Buddha in our hearts, but the idea is the same. So the Christmas season is a good time to let the Christ child in our hearts speak, to attempt to understand it, to become at one with it, so that we, each new Christmas, we may become even more Christ-like, more Buddha-like, more spiritual. Then the Sun of Healing will have arisen with health, with wholeness in its wings, healing our sorrows simply because we as individuals shall have become at one with the spirit of the universe, of which a bright ray lives at the heart of each one of us. The real Christmas can come to us in our hearts. We can realize that there has arrived once more the season we can rise with. If we make up our minds to do it, we can follow the path of our great predecessors, the great saviors of the world, the great saviors of all times. They all come from the same body, whether we call them Buddha, Christ, or any other name. They are all beings of the same nature who come among us, and as was said of Jesus, in all things become like unto us. They may impart to us something of their great knowledge and point us to the path they followed. Always the object of their coming is that we in time may become even as they are. Always they leave messages for us which are set down and known as the sayings of the founders of all great religions. Jesus, for whom the Christian nations celebrate Christmas, was one of the bodies of perfected men. There were many before him, there have been others since, and there will yet be others. Christmas is a time for giving and also receiving, but there is a giving that is not of things. There is a giving of the heart itself. There is a giving of service, of love, of brotherhood, of every thought that makes for good, a given open to all, however poor our personal possessions may be. It is the feeling and the thought in our hearts which reach people and stir their hearts to a better perception, a better feeling, a wider and stronger action. For all our hearts are based in the same one life. We draw all our powers and forces from the one life. The real Christmas means something to the real man, and it applies to the whole of man's nature. Let us take advantage of this resurgence of spiritual, mental, and moral forces that comes from the Christmas time. Once again, the topic for today, the season of rebirth.
A very potent presentation of the ancient ideas that we take up during Christmas time, and we'll just mention a few brief things and then open the floor for discussion and contributions regarding symbolism of Christmas and how some of these symbols represent rebirth. You know, one of which that we all know, of course, is the Christmas tree and the holly and all of this that we decorate our houses with in the Western world. Why do we do all this? Well, on the one hand, the Christmas tree is really a fairly new symbol of Christmas. It just goes back to the 1800s. And yet, it's almost like it's a renewal of an ancient tradition, because in ancient Germany, it was said that the pagan priests would hold high branches from pine trees in a ceremony during the winter solstice, and these pine branches would be ornamentally decorated. It's also said that the branches or trees would be brought into the house, because it was said that the nature spirits lived in these trees, and they would be brought inside so they could stay warm through the winter season. Now, this idea of the Christmas tree, it's kind of a mysterious rebirth for it to come back into the 1800s. But behind that also is just the colors that are represented by the Christmas colors, red and green. Red is representative of the light of Manus. And the evergreens that we have in the homes represent what? Just that one part of nature, of vegetation, that maintains its life through the winter season when all other vegetation seemingly dies or goes into a state of rest, waiting to be reborn with the spring. And there are a number of other symbols that I'm sure you know would come up. Rather than giving some kind of a lecture on symbols, we'd like to open the floor for contributions and all. Yeah.
To continue with the tree, the fir tree, it is a pyramid shape, which gives it even more symbolical meaning. And every time you look at a candle flame, you are seeing that same shape. Pyra, fire, pyramid. It's a potent thing.
Thank you. And just also the lighting, you know, back in the day, they would light candles on the tree, and the idea, one way of interpreting this symbol is, you know, what happens to the candle as the flame burns down? What happens to the wax? It's consumed by the flame. How does that correspond to the Christmas season? Any ideas? Yes.
Giving of yourself.
Giving of yourself, sacrificing your nature to the higher principles. Thank you. Yes?
I think that they did, the church, or the church fathers, pick that time because of the celebration that was going on in Rome for a much more ancient ceremony. Can we have more detail on that?
Well, yes, it's our understanding that Christmas, as we recall, it was a movable feast at first, and then it was fixed at December 25th. So what were these ancient ceremonies or whatever? Well, to get an idea of them, first let's look at the reality of Christmas and what it represents, and whether this, you know, people talk about, you know, was Jesus born on that day, and was Jesus this or that or the savior of men? Well, for the tradition, for any tradition to be real, it has to be factual. It has to be true. Now, if we are historians, the word true means one thing to us. We can go back to a certain date and a certain time and prove that that event happened on that date and time. But if we are theosophists, then the issue is not so much did such and such happen in a certain date and time, but rather we look at the mythologies or the legends and the traditions, and we look for the truth in the tradition. And then, part of ascertaining whether or not there is a bona fide truth in the tradition, and if it's worthy of contemplation, we look to see if the tradition in some way is universal. Is it found in other civilizations, across time, among different peoples? And whatever is the symbolism within the tradition, if it is found, then probably it's some kind, there's an archetypal meaning that has correspondence to what? To the evolution of spirit, to the unfolding and the opening of the inner man within. So let's take a look. The ancient traditions, pre-Christian traditions that were practiced on the 25th correspond to the winter solstice. And when we speak of the winter solstice, you know, there were two ways of looking at the solar system, at the cosmos. And in theosophy, when HBB typically talks about the universe, she says when she talks about the universe, typically she's talking about the solar system. One way to look at it is in terms of quantity, form, and magnitude, anything that can be measured. Your typical astronomer would view certain things. And he knows that the solar system operates according to very definite laws. Another way that the ancients would view the solar system astronomy to the ancient astronomer was the science of the anatomy, the physiology, and the function of the solar system. So he would seek out the purpose and the correspondences whereby the sun of the solar system is the heart, which periodically contracts and sends its fluid of life and light throughout the solar system, just like the heart of a human being or any animal does. Now, this mathematical and philosophical approach among ancients, the synthesis of these two approaches, we know as astrotheology. And the astrotheologist simply uses the solar system and the definite laws that the solar system follows as a basis for religious ethics. So we have, therefore, if we look at the sun, as was said in the talk so elegantly, yes, there is the sun, which is the light and life of life physical on this earth. But the ancients, who were we would say sun worshipers. That's how astrotheologists are known, as they're called sun worshipers. And in a way, that's kind of degrading to the highest ideas of what they really did. The physical sun provides light and life to physical earth, as the spiritual sun provides or shines through our nature, because there is a medium within the nature of the human being which corresponds to the spiritual sun. So there's the outward symbol. The sun and the solar system is an outward symbol of invisible forces which animate all of us and give us purpose. So this winter solstice and the ceremonies that would follow it were simply representations, they were exoteric celebrations for the inner reality of the life and light spiritual, the psycho-spiritual opening during the springtime. So to the astrotheologist, he wasn't a sun worshiper worshiping the sun, but rather, you know, he would look at himself as, am I, like the sun is, always giving life and light, am I a center of light in my family and my community? Yes.
Also, at that time of the year, among different ancient peoples, they worshipped the birth of their sun gods, which were said to have been born on that day. Different traditions. Could something be said about those common threads in those different traditions?
Thank you. So for the tradition of Christmas, as we were saying, for the theosophists to consider it to be true, you know, what is the truth in it, and is it a universal tradition? Well, sun gods, of which the man Jesus is kind of metamorphosed into the representation of a sun god, in different traditions, it's Brahma of the Hindus, Mithras of the Persians, Osiris of the Egyptians, Bel of the Chaldeans, Odonai of the Phoenicians, and Apollo of the Greeks. And in our understanding is these are, you know, this idea of the sun god perhaps is a way to simplify it for the masses, you know, an exoteric presentation of this, of, you know, a Jesus in all these other lands. But often it's a really complex theology in all these different lands that are developed by the priestcraft of a very simple process that really naturally goes on in nature, which simply is the correspondence of the sun, the physical, and the sun spiritual. Does that answer your question? Yes.
Well, just as there may have been an actual historical figure,
mm-hmm.
whose legends grew around the life of that individual, as legends grew around the life of Buddha and Krishna, were these sun gods actual teachers, reformers of different times? But we see that a common story grows around them that maybe is symbolic of something else.
So the question is, you know, were these sun gods actually teachers on the scene? And what about the legends? Well, interestingly, the legends, it's amazing how much how much of the story of Jesus corresponds to the Egyptian story or stories of Osiris and Horus and Isis. It's really amazing. They are templates of each other. So some would say, oh, well, then the stories of Jesus aren't true and they stole those ideas. Well, really, perhaps there were those on the scene who saw the value of the archetypal message in those stories. And because Jesus was a teacher at a time when it was ripe for these stories to continue to be passed on. The very stories that were used as a basis for ethics in ancient Egypt continue today to be used as a basis for ethics when interpreted right. Now, the interpretation of symbols and legends is all according to the intelligence, the emotional development of the people at the time, and just how much we will get out of these stories and symbols is really a matter of the work that we do on ourselves. Yes?
We think one of the threads common through these legends is a virgin birth,
mm-hmm.
and that would be signifying the purity, we think, of the soul coming through at that time, that here is one who in previous periods has done the work of purifying and perfecting their nature, and they're returning in symbolically that way, the virgin birth, the complete purity.
Thank you. Yes?
But we think it also applies to the quality and character of the woman who is going to give birth. And in all the stories, they are visited by someone of power to be told that they are going to have this child.
Thank you. So one of the common threads of these Christ stories is that of the virgin birth. The issue is not just the birth of a sun god, but also the purity of the mother through which he will come. That kind of suggests sometimes we think religion kind of blends or force fits anthropogenesis, the beginning of man, with cosmogenesis, the beginning of the universe, and certainly there are correspondences, but what that reminds us of is that we have to bear in mind we are compound beings and we are comprised in this form of the mother corresponds to what? To matter. And in that sense, the mother of the earth is ultimately the moon. What is represented by the mother in so many of these stories, Mary in the other religion, in Buddhist, the mother was Maya. And that word corresponds to water. And then there's matter, and then there's spirit, which is the male active aspect. And the synthesis of both of them is what we're looking at, because the synthesis of the matter and spirit is the human being. When we remember that man is both a solar being and a lunar being, solar being the higher triad, the immortal aspect of our compound nature, and the lunar being the temporary, transient, impermanent aspect, that perhaps that will give us reason to contemplate the everlasting laws that we were talking about that the solar system follows, such as the values that we place on that part of us which corresponds to the sun, ever giving life and light, will have certain effects on us if we operate from that part of our nature. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yes.
In continuing with your study of symbolism, if you just take the mother, matter,
mm-hmm.
moon, Mary, Maya,
matrix.
They are all M,
mm-hmm.
and the M is the symbol for a wave or water. So if you just take one thing like that and really study it, you begin to see the universality of matter and spirit working together give us the Christ child.
Thank you. Yes, in the back?
We're wondering if there's any significance to the fact that the winter solstice is generally December 21st,
mm-hmm.
and this birth is December 25th. The three-day period in between, is there any significance to an event and then 3 days and then this purity coming into being?
Well, the two things that we've heard regarding those 3 days is, on the one hand, if we were to look at the cycle, just viewing it when it's at the low part, you know, coming into right at the winter solstice, you know, solstice, the what I guess the etymology of that word is the sun stands still or it stays. And there's a period of 3 days where if we're just viewing it, not that we've ever personally done that, mm-hmm. but we understand, it looks like it's staying in the same place for 3 days. And the other, which was mentioned by the earlier speaker, has to do with, could have simply been a change, the change in the calendar. Originally, the winter solstice was fixed in the ancient Roman calendar on the 25th. So, yes.
As we understand it, there's another as well, and that's that the Savior, the sun god, spends 3 days in Hades or in hell, awakening and bringing back to life that which is dead.
The sun god stays 3 days in hell, just as the sun stays in that position for 3 days. And we found it interesting recently, we realized that St. Paul's experience on the way to Damascus, which blinded him, or he had shingles in his eyes or something, and he was blind for how long? 3 days. Interesting. Could have been an initiation experience, we wonder.
And we were just thinking, too, generally, as was just said, initiations are done either underground or in darkness for a period of 3 nights, mm-hmm. and then there is a coming forth sort of back into the light on the next morning.
Thank you. Yes.
Yes. Sometimes you can have a sort of little initiation, an epiphany, because of something you read or something someone says. When we heard the phrase in the talk, within you there is a Prince of Peace. Well, even if we think of something as, well, the Christ principle is in me, that makes it very universal and ethereal. But tell me there is a Prince of Peace within me, that makes it very personal and very direct. So we think initiation goes on all the time, but especially this time of year.
So an initiation goes on all the time, especially during this time of year. And the work that we do on ourselves to recognize it when it happens is very helpful in more fully recognizing our fellow brothers in the world, because the more that we see it in ourselves, the more we can see it in others. If we don't see it in others, it's because we don't see it in ourselves. There's been a hand here.
Well, you know, the most interesting thing, of course.
Could we speak louder, please?
The most interesting thing for us who come into these rooms is our first acquaintance with Isis Unveiled, the red volume. And these ancient tales are listed there in the index. More than one can have it. However, we're often then referred to what came out years later, the secret doctrine. And in the first few pages of the secret doctrine, we are told this is the key to understanding this system. And amazingly, it points more and more to each one of us, separate and as a unit. And we could, you cannot stop, if you're sincere in discovery, what is meant by these holidays, Christmas, Easter. And it's our understanding that this new beginning gives each one of us an opportunity to flow with the time. So we think that the gift of theosophy, the philosophy, is for each and every other individual if he desires to make it his own. It belongs to each one of us.
Thank you. Yes, in the front.
You know, when I think about it, I've been coming off and on for a very long time. You know, it don't seem to be much, but I have my periods, you know. I was in Downingtown. I just moved back from Downingtown. And I was riding my bike, and a start thinking about being here before, being reincarnated in my life as I live, not dying. But I found out that and it's coming back here. And I call this a living reincarnation for me, because I really didn't get the lesson all of the time, and it was something that I missed. You know, what I'm saying is that with reincarnation and rebirth, the similarities, and are there symbols that express the meaning of reincarnation, like the tree and the thing, are symbols you see that express some meaning of rebirth? Are there symbols for the opposite?
Well, perhaps the most clearly understandable symbol for rebirth or for reincarnation is going to bed at night, having that period of rest, and waking up the next morning, previewing our day, focusing on what needs to get done, and actively participating in a mindful, thoughtful way. Don't we accomplish more in a given day when we take a moment in the morning? Maybe it's when we first get to work and plan out what we're going to do, and then in the evening, review what we did so we know where to pick up tomorrow morning where we left off. Sometimes we have much more productive days when we do that. And then there might be other days where a week goes by and you just float through and you wonder what you did, you know? But perhaps day and night is the most helpful symbol of reincarnation. Yes?
We just have a comment and then follow up the question, but it reminds us of a humorous statement. We recently heard a young person say to encapsulate that thought, and they said that during this time, it's a time of reimbirthment.
Okay.
Reimbirthment, okay. Which we thought was quite clever. But the other idea we had was, in the story of Christmas, the idea of the manger was
sure.
Met, where the animals and all the birds there seem to be taking part and feel the influence of that birth, that event. Is that response of nature seen in the legends of other sun gods? And what does it mean, the fact that nature responds like that at this time?
Is that response of nature seen in the legends of other sun gods? Well, what comes to mind is perhaps that nativity scene where the animals are there, they are participating in their own way and submissive to the birth of the Christ child. In a way, ideally, would that not correspond to our own animal nature submitting to the principles and allowing the Christ to be Lord over the being? Oftentimes it's not the case, and oftentimes it is our animal nature which drives our being. So that's a consideration. Ideally, nature is willing to work with the higher principles. Now, as far as the particulars of other traditions, do you have any in mind? We don't know.
It reminds us of this statement, the voice of the silence, which all nature responds in all with the rebirth or the appearance of a new Arhat or Savior on the scene. It's not just the time of uplift for ourselves as human beings, but all the kingdoms of nature feel that spiritual uplift at this time.
Thank you. And so that's in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition. And yes?
In accordance with that, I'm not really good at it, but there's a song, Joy to the World, that heaven and nature sing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yep. Yes?
And we relate that very line to the fact that it describes in the voice of the silence the birth of such a one deep into the night. And there must be a vibrational sort of reverberation throughout the world. There must be a feel the birth of such a one. The only way we can say it. So that thrill of nature and that heaven and nature saying everything responds to this event because it is felt in some way. That vibration is felt.
It is felt with whether it's with the birth of the Arhat or even this time of year. This time of year, we have a friend who lives nearby, who's from Lithuania. And if you don't know where Lithuania is, that's way up north. And during this time of the year, she says that you can literally, physically feel the difference in the air, on your skin, the hairs on your arms. You can literally feel the difference that the effect of the rising sun has. Yes,
yes, it's electrical.
Mm-hmm.
But we were thinking, we see it symbolically every morning of our lives. The earth responds to the sun. Everything awakens and begins to grow more. But we were also thinking, again, the symbology. We don't pay attention. We've been singing these Christmas carols since we were little kids. And there's a song about old little town of Bethlehem, where Jesus is supposed to be born. Bethlehem means city of bread. And city of bread means the human form.
Yeah.
So we always get all of these hints that the Christ has been born within the human. It's wonderful.
It's wonderful. It's wonderful. Yes.
And as to an earlier question about rebirth and its symbology, we were thinking as we finish a karmic lesson, as we overcome and take control of whatever it is we had to learn, we are in that moment different from the moment before and ready for the next birth of the new karmic lesson waiting for us. So there are continual rebirths, we think, throughout our lives. Again, if we were paying attention to them and doing them mindfully, we might get more benefit from
them. Yes, we wonder if after the rebirth, would we say that we are ready for the next rebirth right there? Or are we ready to do the work necessary so that we prepare ourselves for yet another rebirth? Yes.
There's a word that was used in our presentation, and we keep on hearing rebirth and reincarnation, but the speaker was talking about one life. And we know as we grew up, we were always told this is only one life. And now we hear it said that, well, this is the one life. And then rebirth is mentioned in reincarnation. Is there a contradiction here, or is it just a definition?
Both. Both. Well, let's first look at that idea of one life. If the sun is the mirror or the lens of where the speculum of the universal spiritual sun, which is said to be behind it, that spiritual sun, and then suns, all suns throughout the universe, they are universally diffused, they are magnets or lenses or what have you. The human, the soul, our eternal self, evolves according to the same processes as the solar system. And we're told in the teachings that there is that in us which is the medium of the universal invisible sun. So in that sense, that sun is not somewhere out there. It is the center of it is everywhere, and its circumference is nowhere. So it is permanent, immutable, unknowable, yet it is. So it's one life. Now, this rebirth, this coming and going, is all the conditions that are necessary for consciousness to go through so that what? So that we can know ourselves. We come to know more who we are by learning what we're not and these comings and goings, these rebirths and cycles and all, is the opportunity to learn and grow in wisdom according to the laws of nature. And as we learn the laws of nature and learn to work with it, we unfold in certain ways. As Plato says, God geometrizes, and so we unfold in certain ways in terms of our awareness and our consciousness to recognize that the fullness of who we are and the power to be of service and to contribute to the greater purpose of nature, which ultimately is our destiny. Yes.
So it's like we're like minor universes inside of us, and the heart is like the sun. If we can keep the heart pure, if that's possible, with pure thought and everything, we vibrate the cells, and I can actually heal or rebirth if I'm connected to the universal source, whatever, you know. But pure thought and a pure heart seems to be what I need to do.
Well, there are combinations, or there are correspondences and combinations between each individual, each microcosm, and the greater universe, the macrocosm around us. And yes, we're told that to become a, so to speak, a greater, more powerful player, and to fulfill what our destiny truly is, at that point when we realize, wow, there's something to these ideas, we're told that first things first, live a life of virtue, purify yourself. We should all purify ourselves so that, you know, our motive is right, and as we grow, we will unfold according to the laws of nature. If that's not the case, if our motive is not right, we will be constantly checked. We'll be constantly checked by karma until proper adjustments are made to get to the next level and to continue to grow. Yes?
Well, we all seem to hold such stupid ideas that we are needy and sinful and all of these negative things, when we should be filled with some of the light of the reality, just as the earth awakens to the sun. We should awaken to that within us. But we've paid so much attention to outside authority that we don't believe good things about ourselves.
Such is the case, and yet at the same time, you know, if we would just get up with a sense of gratitude for what we have, you know, what we focus on is what grows. So if we focus on what we have in terms of relationships and positive things, and have a sense of gratitude for what is available to us, well, if what we focus on is what grows, then everything that we have will be continue to grow if we are grateful for it and use it in service to others. Yes?
We always thought that the colors of Christmas signify the earth and our passion, or our compassion, that it is, because this time of year you feel love and connection with all of life. So are we correct in that supposition, that it is really a time of feeling and of love?
We're trying. What we remember is does red not correspond to the light of mind? Or help
spirit.
Us out.
Yes.
Red is spirit, and the green corresponds to
earth and life.
Earth and life. Thank you.
But,
yes.
Okay.
Go ahead.
We were just thinking, when at this time of year, if it snowed during the course of the evening, and you get up and walk out in the evening, there is a feeling of silence. Just standing there or walking into the snow. So we were wondering, it's in the air. It's like we feel it, we pick it up.
We're sensitive to the changes that all of nature is recognizing and accept. You know, it's we're told that the seed in the ground actually starts to germinate in the winter, under the snow, as a result of the sun's rays, and we don't see that effect until it starts poking through the ground in the spring. But there's stuff going on early on. Yes.
If there is a standing still or a moment of change from one phase to the next, in the astronomical event, wouldn't its correspondence in nature be a moment of silence, a transition from one cycle to the next? And we would feel that in ourselves as well.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Going back to the colors of Christmas for a minute, you have the red and the green, or spirit and matter, or fire and substance. And when you set fire to an evergreen bough, the fire converts that into itself, which is another symbol. Fire or spirit takes matter and converts it back into spirit.
It's similar to the analogy of the candle,
exactly.
Which ultimately is that not what's going on in the human constitution over the course of incarnations? Where yes.
Because I was thinking about depression and how this time of year so much depression is so much greater this time of year than in the springtime. So to me, it's a I attribute rebirth to more of the springtime than in the dead winter. You know, why is that?
Could you say that? The what?
You know, rebirth to me seems like it's more symbolic of the springtime when life is popping up and, you know, coming up. You know,
sure.
You know, that you get spring fever.
Sure.
And you feel like, oh, you know, the sun comes up and you.
Right. So what's that about? You know, so springtime actually seems to be the time when everything is responding. But that's the effect. That's the outward visible effect of causes and forces that are actually at work earlier in the year with the winter solstice. That it's with the winter solstice that whole cycle actually begins. So behind the scenes, under the snow, in the midst of the depression that some people very much have during this time of the year, if you're a student of this philosophy, you can know that things are starting to change. And if you do, and make certain decisions and commitments to change with it, the way we think and have a sense of expectation and willingness to work with the flow of the law, then that could result in yet a more grandiose springtime if we're working with the cycle. Yes.
You might also remind us.
It's kind of like catching the wave early on. If you catch the wave early on, you can ride on top of that wave pretty easily. But if you catch it when it's already cresting, you're not going to benefit as much from the wave. I'm sorry.
Just to draw an analogy to that, in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna's first influence and instruction to Arjuna is in the moment of his despair and despondency. So we might be at the darkest point of our cycle and the most ripe for the influence.
I see. At the darkest point of our cycle, we may be at just ripe for the influence. There was an interesting story we came across in this pamphlet written by HPB that talked about the scene with the manger, and we never heard it before we came to the lodge, and we'll just finish up with this. It's in the nativity scene, and it explains the legend of why lights are put on Christmas trees. Near the cave in which was born the Savior of the world grew three trees, a pine, an olive, and a palm. On that holy eve, when the guiding star of Bethlehem appeared in the heavens, that star which announced the long-suffering world, announced to the long-suffering world the birth of him who brought to mankind the glad tidings of a blissful hope. All nature rejoiced and is said to have carried to the feet of the infant God her best and holiest gifts. Among others, the olive tree that grew at the entrance of the cave of Bethlehem brought forth its golden fruits. The palm offered to the babe its green and shadowy vault as a protection against heat and storm. Alone, the pine tree had naught to offer. The poor tree stood in dismay and sorrow, vainly trying to think what it could present as a gift to the child Christ. Its branches were painfully drooping down, and the intense agony of its grief finally forced from its bark and branches a flood of hot, transparent tears, whose large, resinous, and gummy drops fell thick and fast around it. A silent star, twinkling in the blue canopy of heaven, perceived these tears, and forthwith, confabulating with her companions, lo, a miracle took place. Hosts of shooting stars fell down like unto a great rain shower on the pine until they twinkled and shone from every needle from top to bottom. Then, trembling with joyful emotion, the pine proudly raised her drooping branches and appeared for the first time before the eyes of a wondering world in most dazzling brightness. From that time, the legend tells us, men adopted the habit of ornamenting the pine tree on Christmas Eve with numberless lighted candles. Our meaning is adjourned.